You've probably heard of gut health or the no sugar diet as being all the rage these days, but what about hormonal health, especially for women, which may have more influence over how well you sleep, work and play than you might think? Well, Adelaine Ng spoke with Belinda Kirkpatrick, the author of a new book, Healthy Hormones, to find out a bit more.
Belinda, usually when we talk about hormones, unfortunately, it's in the same sentence as a joke about someone's behaviour. But, you know, hormones is a serious study for you. What do you wish more people understood?
Yeah, that's a fantastic intro, actually, because it is that. And, you know, I'm really hoping that this kind of, I guess, opens up those conversations and makes hormones a really normal thing. I think, look, the thing with kind of women's health is that so much of our health is actually determined by our hormones and so many other symptoms rather than sort of that, like you mentioned, being hormonal, you know, have possibly to come down to hormones. So whether that's things like skin or energy or weight, bloating, fluid retention, mood, all those sorts of things can be, hormonally modulated. And that can be at different times of the cycle. It's not just that kind of like premenstrual time when people kind of talk about being hormonal.
That's quite a long list that you spelled out there. I mean, not even my female doctor talks to me about hormones. And that, I guess, gives us an idea of how buried this subject is. Now, you say that there are about 100 hormones that keep us healthy, and even if one is disrupted, we sort of become out of whack. I mean, that sounds awfully precarious. Can you give some examples of how that actually plays out?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I guess that's sort of, yeah, out of whack. It's not sort of like then, you know, everything kind of goes crazy from there. But all our hormones, as with sort of most systems in the body, they all sort of balance and work on each other. So when I do talk about hormonal balance in the book or to my clients, it is a really funny kind of concept, I guess, to sort of talk about, because it's not like there is some perfect balance for everybody. I guess it's just when your hormones are balanced for you that you'll end up sort of feeling better. So for example, if your estrogen levels are high, estrogen and progesterone live on a bit of a seesaw. So you can have this kind of relative progesterone deficiency, even though your progesterone levels themselves might not be low, but they're low in comparison to estrogen, because estrogen's high, that can push progesterone to kind of being low. So if you imagine them sort of sitting on a seesaw, which is a little bit simplistic, but for the sake of kind of understanding, it helps that, you know, when one's high, one can be low. So you can get these sort of relative excesses or relative deficiencies of different hormones in comparison to each other. So when one's out, sometimes that throws others out as well.
And those two hormones are quite interesting. I was just reading that progesterone and estrogen sometimes have opposite jobs. They do the very opposite things to each other, which can be a tricky balance to handle. But how does somebody actually find out if they have too much of one, not enough of the other, etc.?
Yeah. Great question. So there are blood tests that can be done. If they are going to be done, though, they need to be done at particular times of the cycle. So often I get women coming to me with these series of blood tests, and I'll say, oh, and I try to look at them and try to work out where they might have been in their cycle. And I say, you know, where were you in your cycle here? And they're like, oh, I don't know. I think it was day 10 or sort of like any day, they can't remember. And that information really gives us nothing. So to measure estrogen, we really want to be measuring that on day 2 or 3 of the menstrual cycle. So that's kind of like day 1 being the first day of bleeding. You'd measure that day 2 or day 3. And progesterone is a little bit more tricky to measure, because it is a blood test too, which is easy, but it needs to be done a week after ovulation and or a week before your period, which sort of should be the same thing. So for women that don't know exactly when their next period's due or when they're ovulating, that one can be a little bit tricky. So sometimes, you know, we can have a look at those blood tests and they can give us a really good idea. But to be honest, most of the time when women come in and talk to me about their symptoms, I can really give them an idea as to kind of whether that's going to be that they tend to kind of have higher or lower estrogen or kind of lower progesterone. You sort of seem to kind of tend to be able to kind of pick that up through their symptoms.
But you do say many of our hormone-related health issues can be fixed with the right food. So explain that connection between food and hormones. I mean, I'm wondering, does eating rice or having an ice cream affect us in more areas than just our waistline?
Look, as a one-off, I mean, I'm a massive believer in balance, you know, so I really do think that if you can sort of eat well 80% of the time, then 20% can be fun and, you know, gelatos and pizzas and whatever it is that you kind of enjoy doing. If you're trying to kind of fix up a specific health condition or you're working on something, an issue with your health, you probably want to kind of keep that ratio more like 90-10. So it's definitely not about kind of being perfect all the time or not having any fun. But it's also about, I guess, knowing and having that, you know, feeling a bit empowered to know that if you do have certain symptoms, that there are foods that could potentially help. So, for example, if you were sort of diagnosed with having that kind of estrogen excess, and that may be linked to things like uterine fibroids or mood swings, heavy periods, sugar cravings, easy weight gain, fatigue, fluid retention, those sort of things tend to be kind of linked to high estrogen, then you could be doing foods that are higher in fiber to help to reduce that estrogen excess. So adding things like a tablespoon of flax seeds or LSA to your food daily, eating lots of these brassica types of vegetables. So things like broccoli, cauliflower, asparagus, kale, spinach, Brussels sprouts, if you like them. They're so good roasted, by the way. you know, those foods can help to actually bind up and remove excess estrogen and help your body to metabolize it better. So, you know, there are these sort of things that we can be doing with food to help some of those symptoms that we're having, but also that's going to also then help to affect that overall sort of hormonal balance.
Can you talk a bit about environmental estrogens? Because you do dedicate a chunk of your book to this subject. I think there is growing awareness that, you know, we've got to start thinking about what we're using in our household and our personal care products as well. And I don't know, I'm one of those people that, I'm hearing, but I'm not completely doing yet. Just because, you know, it's a habit change. Maybe I'm not 100% convinced yet.
Yep.
What can you speak to that?
Yeah. So the things around you, so the foods you eat, the products you use, all that kind of stuff can really impact your health. And, you know, I think that we're starting to, well, science is starting to kind of catch up now that a lot of cleaning products and perfumes and personal care products, things like that, and plastic, so plastic drink bottles, you know, heating up food in plastic takeaway containers, those plastics and those chemicals and those products can actually release these things called endocrine disrupting chemicals. So that's kind of like a scientific class of chemicals that have actually been shown to disrupt our endocrine system, which is just the scientific word for hormonal system. So we know that these things can actually affect our hormonal balance. And I think they're doing more and more research now to actually understand the sort of these ongoing effects. So, you know, yes, painting your nails, you know, and using your beautiful perfume every now and again is unlikely to be a problem on its own. But when you couple that with, you know, daily use of these things, daily exposure to bleachers and, you know, bathroom cleaners and floor cleaners and perfumes and makeups and things like that, we're starting to kind of start to learn the impact of these things on our health and our hormones. And I mean, I think the thing too, personally, is that, you know, if you have any products at home, and obviously personal care products don't have these things on them, although perhaps they should, but with cleaning products, you know, they've all got that poison sign on the back of them. Like, we know that they're highly toxic kind of products, but for some reason we sort of assume that by putting gloves on and, you know, wiping the bench or the bath, that these things are, there's no residue of these poisons kind of left in our house. But, you know, when you sort of really think about it, you're like, well, you know, there probably are still residues of those poisons, you know, in my shower recess, and then I go and have a hot shower later that day and stand in it and all the fumes come up and you probably can't even smell it, or although sometimes you can. But they're these kind of the impact of these things happening day after day after day. And look, for some people, they're not really going to notice a difference. They've got great genetics, great constitution. You know, these build-up effects, it doesn't really seem to kind of bother them. But I think with more and more of these products being flooded onto the market, there certainly is a large group of people who are affected by these things, you know, over time.
And then it might spill on into something that is much more serious, some of the conditions that we were talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, there's been quite a few scientific studies actually looking at what the grandmother is exposed to. That can actually, say, affect then not only, say this is your mother, what she was exposed to can affect not only your health, but also your children's health as well. So, I mean, it's starting to become, you know, these kind of like multi-generational things that we're seeing. And those big studies are done with things like pesticides and herbicide exposures. So people who are actually exposed to larger quantities of things, that can then filter down and affect the health of kind of like the granddaughters as well. So a couple of studies looking at the incidence of polycystic ovarian syndrome in these kind of like granddaughters of people who are exposed to stuff. So I think it's important that we're looking after not only our world and our own health, but also the health of kind of these future generations as well.
Now, of personal interest to me is the condition called endometriosis. I have a number of friends in their 30s and 40s who've suffered that, and sometimes surgery has not solved the problem. Do you have any insights here? I mean, sometimes we're even told by doctors to go on the contraceptive pill for months without a break to avoid having a period altogether. I mean, is that the kind of advice you're comfortable with?
Well, I mean, the thing is the way that I work is really integratively. So, you know, I just want the best health and happiness and life for each individual person that I see and that I talk to. So it's not necessarily, you know, don't use any medication where it's kind of needed. And I think that the contraceptive pill, the one area where it does have use is women with, you know, quite severe endometriosis, and actually doing that kind of like back-to-back taking the pill, like you mentioned, can actually help to keep their own inflammatory kind of hormones suppressed and can keep everything at bay and potentially reduce ongoing damage to their reproductive organs, but also their bowel and their bladder and things like that. So I think when you've got any of those kind of conditions that are quite severe, sometimes a combination of, you know, orthodox medicine and complementary medicine is probably the best thing that you can be doing. Coming back to when you said, you know, sometimes people will have surgery and it doesn't even work, or it has, they have surgery and it works and, you know, 4, 5, 6 months later it's kind of back again, is it because it doesn't really address the underlying causes. So that's not to say at all that surgery isn't wrong. It absolutely has its place, and women with endometriosis who have had successful surgeries will absolutely kind of attest to that. But I think the thing with endometriosis is we're starting to learn more and more about it. So it was considered to be a very much a hormonal condition, too much estrogen. And what basically is happening is that the lining of the uterus is growing outside the uterus. So that's been caused kind of like really bad pain, particularly during the menstrual cycle, but also at any other time in the cycle as well. And now that we're actually starting to kind of get more research behind it, well, it's actually potentially being looked at as a bit of an immune dysfunction or a problem with the immune system. So an inflammatory type of immune issue or immune disease that then impacts the hormones. So I think the way that we're sort of treating it is going to start to kind of change as we start to really understand what's happening with that. But certainly, you know, lots of fish oils are really important to reduce the inflammation, trying to reduce your exposure to those environmental estrogens, trying to avoid heating foods in plastic or using plastic water bottles. And again, it's trying to kind of reduce that excess estrogen coming in from the environment. Lots of turmeric, sometimes even turmeric supplementally works beautifully. It's really anti-inflammatory. So it's basically trying to kind of reduce inflammation in the body, as well as helping to kind of reduce some of those excess estrogen levels as well.
I think we will very much be watching that space, so with great interest.
I think so, yeah. And more research needs to be done on endometriosis. But there is growing awareness thanks to some really fantastic groups and people that are really starting to kind of like bring it out there, which is good.
Yeah. And, you know, as you say, your book comes with a bunch of recipes. And I must say, Ainsley, your co-author, has done a great job. The food looks great. And I guess in terms of how we use the recipes, do we just gravitate to certain ones depending on whether it's estrogen or progesterone that we need more of?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think the thing with the recipes is that they're all going to be good for all hormonal conditions. So anything that you like the look of, you know, you love, you know, chicken, you love eggs, or you love lentils and things, you can kind of go obviously more specifically to those kind of recipes. But each introduction does give a little bit of introduction to what that might be good for. So, you know, if you know that there is a little bit more of that estrogen excess, you might be like, oh, I'm going to be doing that coleslaw with chicken and avocado dressing for lunch, because, you know, it's got lots of ingredients in there that are fantastic for helping me, you know, remove this excess estrogen through my liver and through my digestive system. But at the same time, you know, we want people to be able to feel empowered and educated that the food that they're eating is good for them specifically. But at the same time, without getting kind of like too stressed about, oh, that recipe doesn't say that it's specifically good for me. They're all going to have this balance of protein, good fats, and something fresh, which is usually vegetables or could be fruit. And that's really my mantra through the book and through my clinical practice as well. It's just making sure that our food is full of like protein, good fats, and something fresh. Pretty much sort of, I guess, whole foods and unprocessed, but we're trying to make it really simple. So there's lots of information out there, and this just aims to kind of bring it into the one book so that people don't get sort of so confused about trying to be perfect or trying to do the right thing. It's just about moving towards a more healthy diet by just understanding your own body and the way that it works.
Well, that sounds doable. And if the blueberry pancakes are going to turn out as good as they look in the book, I'm definitely for that.
Yeah, that's they're quick and easy too, which is kind of surprising. But yeah, they're good.
And almond meal. Never thought of that for blueberry pancakes.
Yeah. Easy to make and full of protein, keep you full for longer. You know, you feel like you're having a bit of a treat, but there's nothing in there that you shouldn't be eating.
Ticks all the boxes. Belinda, thank you so much for speaking with us. It's been really enlightening.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for your time.
That was Belinda Kirkpatrick of Healthy Hormones speaking there with Adelaine Ung. You're listening to the Travel Writers Show on JAIR 87.8 FM.